Turning our attention next to weather, and we've had some severe weather, severe rains, severe droughts, depending on where you are, and our weather guys are with us to talk about it. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve, good to see you.
It's great to be back in Madison.
Easy worldwide travel.
Yeah, right. It's a hard job, but it's also not that much fun sitting in a meeting all day long.
No. That's the worst part of it. John Martin, too, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, too, Larry.
Letting a little beard grow there.
Well, it's I don't see students five times a week now, so I got a face made for radio.
Oh, man. Well, what is it with this 8 to 10 inches of rain that we got in Duluth? That's Duluth Superior.
Yeah, pretty wild. Although, you know, when you think about it, look, historically, you have the Boundary Waters blowdown a few years ago, 1999. Mm-hmm. There's something called the Ring of Fire, which is a really interesting phenomena. When in the summertime, when we get big clockwise rotating air masses, big anticyclonic ridges over the central part of the North American plains, the northern periphery of those ridges is very often characterized by pretty intense thunderstorms for a variety of dynamical reasons, and that's exactly what happened to Duluth this last week, in a fairly impressive way. I mean, sometimes 5 or 6 inches of rain is what comes out of those things, but, you know, getting upwards of 10 is unusual, but just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And was that 10, like, in a day, 24-hour period or something?
I think
like that?
There was 10 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, yeah.
That's a lot of water to get rid of.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. Especially when you're in a bluffy, you know, topographically interesting area like that. Yeah. So.
And actually, there's some interesting satellite images, too, of Lake Superior. All along the coastline now, that whole tip was all red and from soil.
Oh, is that right?
Ran off into the lake.
Runoff.
Yeah,
the runoff.
Tremendous amount of new soil put into the lake, probably, yeah.
Yeah, it was a terrible time, and we'll probably at some point or another, somebody from Duluth Superior area is probably going to call in, and we'll hear some more about it. But Bob in Eau Claire has a question for you guys, and let's just turn there. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, fellas.
Good morning.
Earlier this morning, Kathleen Dunn had a guest who has been an official in a couple of different Republican administrations. And he was asked a question by a listener about climate change. Mm. And his response was disingenuous at best, I felt. In essence, what he said was, we do not have 100% consensus among scientists. Therefore, there can't be climate change. Mm. And that just didn't ring true to me. I'm not sure that there's a 100% consensus on many things that are scientific, but, you know, what does it take for people such as yourselves to acknowledge, yes, there is a problem, yes, things are changing, yes, the evidence is pointing to that change, and at what point do we say, you know what, this really is a reality. We really are in the middle of a problem. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I think we're at that. I mean, it's just what you said. We look at what's the evidence, and the evidence is overwhelming that warming is occurring. But then the next step, of course, is always to say, do we physically understand physical rules that would lead to this warming? And the physics that would go with the warming is also in step with what we're seeing. And right. So is there 100% agreement? I think you could probably argue there's not 100% agreement on any scientific issue, including gravity.
Yeah, I was
because you can find
thing.
Somebody who would argue about one of the gravitational laws, maybe a constant or something like that. So, but, you know, it's kind of silly to be talking about 100%.
Right. If that's the standard, then we never make progress in any human endeavor. It's impossible. Mm. And I think one of the grand things about science is that there are moments when what one does as a scientist is purely observe observations of what has already occurred or what is present in front of you right now. But then there are theoretical moments and theoretical thinkers who will say, about those observations. Ah, I understand. I'm beginning to understand an underlying theory that connects them all. And now, based on that theory, I can make a prediction about some of the things we might see in the near term or in the long term in the future. And when some of those predictions that are now 15 or 10 years old start to actually bear fruit and you turn out to be right, it's awfully exciting to realize that you're on the path of something and you're in the right direction. The only thing I'd say to a person like that is, where are the people who can testify to having made 10-year-old predictions about global cooling? They don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be a critic of the prevailing scientific view, and but not offer an alternative scientific view with no alternative predictions. And, of course, there's no such people out there. They're not making those predictions, and they're not seeing them come to fruition.
So you can be a critic but not dismissive.
Right.
You can
That's
say,
right.
I'm going to criticize you, and here's my evidence of why,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know what,
fair.
I'm not going to follow this
that's
because
right.
I don't believe it.
That's perfectly fair. And, you used the wrong verb, and I know this is part of the way the discussion gets carried on in public, is believe. It's not a matter of belief. You just said in your discussion the idea that you analyze the data and you come to a conclusion about how to interpret the data and what it might be pointing towards. That's not a matter of belief. That's a matter of rational analysis.
And if you were going to do a percentage, the percentage of scientists out there is probably 99.
It's in the upper high 90s
right.
that agree and recognize that global warming is occurring, and it's an issue that we should be facing and figuring out what, if anything, we're going to do about it.
Right. Yeah. And let's face the fact, too, that there's a monetary incentive to be a renegade here, because there's a lot of money that would like to have people spout a view that is contrary to the consensus view.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some incentive to take the contrarian view. But there's no evidence for it.
There's a lot we could talk about. Let's go to Phil. Let's go to Phil in McHenry, Illinois. Phil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, you guys. I've called in the past a couple times and told you guys that here just south of Lake Geneva, we was at 200% of normal rainfall for 2 years in a row. Well, now I'm at 35% below normal rainfall, which I guess reinforces the old statement, if you don't like the weather in Chicago, just wait, it'll change in a minute. My question is it true that if you get in a dry area where it becomes droughty, that the dry area actually feeds the continuing dry cycle by not submitting humidity to the environment? And is it also true that you need a major event like a hurricane, tropical storm, to stir up the environment to break down those set patterns once they get established?
Yeah, it might be an exaggeration, your latter point, that you need some almost cataclysmic event to get things going again. But the reason why that might even be hypothesized is because your first point has a lot of validity to it. The fact that there's a lot of water involved in the water table in the ground. Plants are evapotranspirating. It's effectively respiring, and one of their respirant chemicals is water in the vapor form. And so when it starts to get dry, there's a whole long list of plants that don't have roots deep enough to any longer attack that water table. So you only have a few, maybe the biggest trees are the only things that are actually getting to the water table. And they are, 10%, let's say, of your local evapotranspirative plant life. Suddenly, you better have water vapor coming towards your location from another spot in the country. It's not any more local, and it does start to feed back on itself, keeping you dry.
Mm, yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show if you've got a question or a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You keep tabs on the severe weather predictions. What precautions do you take, if anything? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. Email from Steve in Madison. Do you know of any correlation between areas stricken by droughts having increased tornado threats after the drought ends?
Boy, no. I don't. Can't think of any.
Yeah,
no.
Me either.
And I'm not sure what the connection would be.
Me either.
I mean, it's pretty hard to connect tornadoes to anything because they're such a localized event that comes out of a severe thunderstorm.
Yeah, one thing that maybe comes to mind is if somebody can tell you, hey, on Wednesday our drought ended, that probably means they got like a 5-inch rain out of a thunderstorm. And then once in a while, maybe such a potent rain event could drop a tornado and a person could begin to develop that sense that there's a connection. But I think it's purely circumstantial.
Yeah. And I see, I was watching this morning of the hurricane, is it Debbie?
Whatever.
Yeah, in the Gulf of Mexico.
There were tornadoes associated with with the hurricane?
Actually, if you look at a map of where does most tornadoes occur, it happens in Florida, and it's associated.
Is that right?
Yeah, but they're very weak in comparison to what you get in Oklahoma and the so-called tornado belt. Because, yeah, you get a lot of violent hurricane will stir up a lot of weak tornadoes.
Yeah, at landfall. That's a big problem. Yeah.
And now they're going to, it looks like some areas down there are going to get 10 inches.
Yeah, in fact, the week of the Duluth flood, there was rain in Pensacola on the order of 15 or more inches in some locations. And it wasn't with an organized tropical storm, just kind of a disorganized tropical convection. So it's that time of year.
Yeah, and this thing's heading for Gainesville now? Is
I think
that
that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have Victor in West Allis with a comment or question. Victor, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, I've been following all this global warming. And when I was a child, because I'm 67 coming up, we used to be worried about global cooling. Okay? I was born in 1945. Okay, here's the thing. I was telling a young lady who was answering the phone, I believe global warming could be regional. Like, example, you take Africa, where all the trees have been stripped. I think sometimes the pitch of the earth could have a lot to do with it. I think if you look back in the 15th century where the earth was pitched a little differently, well, if I understand the history right, about the 15th century, they didn't get any warmer in July to about 50 degrees. So what do you think about that theory?
Well, climate is a regional aspect, and it will change. And the question then becomes, as you look at climate change, what's the region that you're looking at? And your region could be, as small as a particular lake or a particular area around a lake, or it can be the entire globe. And so when you look at the entire globe, the way the climate is now going is that it's warming. When you look at certain regions in Wisconsin, you'll find that even in the summertime, the average temperatures are actually slightly cooling. So there is a regional aspect with it, but when you put the perspective of, most changes across the world, and even average that over a year, even though summertime coolings in areas of Wisconsin switch to over a year of total warming.
Yeah, and some of that summertime cooling Steve's referring to, maybe this is true, I don't know, Steve, you might have some other thoughts, is that the daytime maximum temperatures in some locations are actually maybe going down a degree or two, but the overnight lows are higher
still going
than they
up.
Used to be. So when you average it all out for a daily temperature, you actually find it's even in that case, you've got an average daily temperature. It's a little bit higher than it used to be. It's just that it's occurring at night when you don't notice.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's been interesting in terms of, the climate of Wisconsin and the warming, that people are generally now saying that it's not that we're getting hotter, it's that we're getting less cold. And that's because the minimum temperatures are not getting as cold.
Right.
The winters are not getting as cold. But, recently we've had these 90-degree days, and the last 90-degree day was what year that we've had? Do you remember?
The
last 100. The last 100-degree day, which we haven't had one in a while.
I'll say 1995.
That's when it was.
July 13th, 1995.
Yeah. Wow, well, I got the date.
And coming up this week, we got a 96 temperature, a high of 96 for Madison.
On Thursday, but it might go to 100.
It might go to 100.
It's possible.
Yeah. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is the backdrop pretty much for everything we do, and sometimes, like the recent flooding up north, it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. And whether it's a lack of rain that affects our crops or so much that it causes massive flooding, we have to respect the power that our weather has. And no matter what's going on, it's always fascinating, and we're lucky to have our weather guys with us until 12:30 today. Steve Ackerman and John Martin will be sharing their knowledge of climate and weather. Happy to answer your questions when you phone in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And I hope you go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You need to go there, The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo, weather photo, or question or comment, and we will get back to you with some answers. Stay with us back after the news. Well, weather is fascinating for most of us, maybe because it seems to be one of the few things that we haven't figured out how to control. And certainly when there are spectacular displays like blizzards or tornadoes or rainbows that really gets our attention. We're enjoying our regular monthly visit with the weather guys today. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. And Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and a professor here as well. Great to have you guys back. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
said
that in time, too.
We do almost everything together.
Oh, well, Steve, you just got back from Europe, and last year they had a warmer than average summer. Then they had a record breaking cold winter. What kind of summer are they having this year?
It has been pretty close to normal. Yeah. I mean, I was in a training session in Italy, just south of Rome, in a very nice area. Although it got pretty hot, but it was normal hot in the 80s and dry, which helps to make it seem hot.
Yep.
And then in a NASA collaborative meeting with the European Meteorological Research Groups on looking at some new satellite programs. And that was in Paris, and that rained most of the time. So
Normal, in other words.
Yep.
We had an email wondering about the weather in Asia this year. Any storms pushing the subtropical jet stream into the polar jet stream this year, getting that super jet that they were sometimes talk about?
The polar jet retreats in the summertime, so it's not usually a big
retreats
player.
Poleward,
so it retreats poleward, right. Yeah. So it's kind of way north. And so we're finding, and this is our first summer of looking at this day to day, but we're finding that the jet structure across much of the northern hemisphere is almost entirely characterized as a subtropical jet. Polar jet is way up in northern Canada, so that this is not a particularly favorable time of year for the interaction between the two jet features, is what it looks like. But there is some interesting things going on in Asia. Big fires in Indonesia, and I think there's some smog in some of the cities. Kuala Lumpur, I think, is got. I saw a picture today in the newspaper. Horrible smog from smoke in the Indonesian fires.
And
it's very often the beginning of one of the ENSO cycles, and I forget which one. It must be drier than normal in the maritime continent, and that probably means it's cooler. The ocean's water is cooler there. And
so the El Nino is moving out, so they're not getting
the
rain.
Yeah, so they're getting towards the other side of the face. So. Yeah. Lots of interesting things going on around the globe.
Kurt in Superior has a question for you. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, good morning. Great discussion. Thank you for your good program today. I'm calling from Superior, and the question that I had was, why, in your opinion, why was the landscape kind of in the country areas or out in the county more resilient during last week's storm? And the cities, the roads, the culverts, all the man-made structures just seem to fall apart so quickly.
That's a good question.
Yeah. And there's some answers for that, though.
Yeah, I don't know if I know what they are, but I know that this is a problem where meteorology borders with civil engineering and various other things. But I think one of the issues can be that when you develop land, you tend to get rid of a lot of plant life and various things that work to hold the soil together. And so there's not as many roots in the soil within the city of Duluth as there might be out in the countryside. And this wasn't an unprecedented and absolutely epic event, even though it's an unusual event. And so the ecosystem, the natural ecosystem, can handle a 10-inch rainfall in the summertime and not, go to pieces. But the man-made land around such areas might not be able to take that because it may not have been developed long enough to have seen one of these events, and so forth, and therefore it's kind of a brand new seminal event for the land that's already been developed. So that might be part of it, land use.
There you go, Kurt. Thank you. Dan in Bellevue, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. I got a historical weather question for you. I'm an avid historian, and I know there have been times when the whole planet has had ice ages, and there's been other times when Alaska had tropical forest in it, and I'm wondering what caused, before man was on the planet, what were causing the Earth to heat up and cool down in historical terms?
Okay.
I think the primary thing would be what we call the Milankovitch cycles, which is changes in how the Earth rotates around the sun. And that determines how much solar energy is absorbed in certain regions of the Earth. And if you look at the cycles of the Earth's orbit, which include its periodicities and its tilt, In the eccentricity of the orbit, and then how we wobble. We actually wobble a little bit like a top. And you combine those and then look at the temperature records. They kind of match up so that when everything's just right, we get a lot of solar energy coming in on the surface, and that leads to global warming in comparison to, you know, averaging over hundreds of thousands of years.
Mm. Yeah, and there's chemical changes that are subtle that go on, too, over long, long periods of time. I don't think I know what the answer is to all of them, but it has something to do with the interaction between the atmosphere, collection of gases, and the degree of forestation and vegetation on the planet. That's not constant either, and so it's moving back and forth. If you go far enough north today, you get to the so-called tree line, north of which there are no trees. And so trees are a great way to absorb carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And if you have a larger population of trees at a certain time in Earth's history, you may have a smaller fraction of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And things feed back and forth through those processes as well.
Very cool. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Andrew in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding a theory that I had heard espoused a little while ago about global dimming. When they noticed it was right after the 9/11 attacks, when all the aircraft were grounded for a few days and there were no contrails in the air, they noticed that a larger percentage of sunlight was reaching the Earth, a measurably larger percentage. And they had discovered that due to this. It has something to do with the fact that our air is cleaner than it's been like in the last 100 years or so, and there's less particulates in the atmosphere. So, I was wondering, they discovered an increase, I guess, in the global warming speed when they had discovered that the air was getting cleaner. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so global dimming is, as I understand it, you know, before we had satellites, we want to know how much solar energy is coming in. That was a regular measurement made with actually spherical crystals. And they would burn strips of paper in it like a magnifying glass. It's kind of a cool measurement. And global dimming was associated with the amount of direct sunlight coming down at the surface was less of it, particularly between 1950 and up until about Pinatubo.
91.
Yeah. And that varied, as you might imagine, locally, depending on where you were, because it was a function, they believed, once they removed the effects of clouds, due to aerosols. You know, so more smoke, more dust on a particular year is going to reduce that and cause less solar energy to reach the surface. But since since after Pinatubo, I think they've gone back and looked at that record more carefully, and it's not really decreasing very much in terms of the incoming solar energy. Now, there was a study with regard to the contrails after 9/11 when the jets were settled down, and what people have generally found, looking theoretically, and I think also looking at surface measurements, is that contrails, if you have them, tend to warm the surface some more. And primarily by, again, as we were talking about earlier, suppressing the nighttime cooling. And so that's one of the things that they discovered after 9/11, some observational evidence of that to support the theory.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve,
am I not on?
No, you're right. No, you're.
Oh,
you're,
yes, I have to go.
Yeah, you were. I think you have to leave.
Yeah, I gotta.
I'm not asking you to leave, but I think you have to go.
Right. I'm really sorry to miss the last 15 minutes.
Steve's got a meeting with some officials and
up the hill, as I like to call it.
Yeah, up the chancellor levels people. So, but you'll be back next month, the last Monday. I'm sure of that. He will. In the meantime, John's here, and John's not leaving.
No, I'm not leaving.
he's here, and he's doing fine. And so global dimming, Steve did a good job on that. Let's go to Rob and see what Rob's got to say from the Madison area. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing? I'm a contractor in Madison, and the weather affects my work many days.
Mm. Yep.
So I really pay attention to the radar loops. And I've noticed very frequently how as storms approach Dane County from the west, there tends to be this phenomenon where the storms would actually split up and go north and south of Madison frequently. Madison would get no rain, but there'd be lots of rain north and south. And it doesn't happen every time, but many times it does. And I was wondering if it was a topographical, I mean, or geographical issue.
Yeah,
in the west that splits it up. Is it?
Well, I've been watching that too. It's real pain.
A lot of contractors, people who work outside for a living, and sports enthusiasts in the summertime notice this a lot. And I don't think that they are being betrayed. They're not just remembering the times when they saw it and forgetting all the ones they didn't. And you said yourself that it doesn't happen all the time. There's been no systematic study that I'm aware of about this phenomenon, but it's been talked about around here for a long time. There may well be a topographic relationship that has something to do with at least the tendency for it to occur once in a while. Most of the time, the weather is moving from west to east in the middle latitudes, and we're firmly in the middle latitudes here in Madison. And there is a little bit of a rise in the topography, and a fairly isolated rise in the topography just to our west here in Dane County. I'd say north and west and west. And so,
the Blue Mounds area.
Exactly right. That's exactly what I was thinking about. And with on days in which thunderstorms form, there might be some fraction of those days that are accompanied by pretty strong winds. I'm thinking about Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of last week when it was windy and warm and humid, but we didn't get any storms. But those might be the kind of days on which, if a storm does develop in Sauk County, let's say, it does have a tendency to maybe reform north and south of the obstacle that the west wind might hit at around the Blue Mounds area. And then that leaves much of central Dane County high and dry. It's not an impossible thing to believe, but it would be really nice to be able to systematically study that and see if that's in fact what happens. It would take a lot of observations, some money to pay for the instruments to do that, but I think it would be a really interesting study, and I think we would probably bear out your idea.
Yeah.
Well, great. Yeah, thank you very much.
I
would like to see that done, because I'd really love to know if it's like a lake effect thing, or if the mass of the city,
I think it's more the topography. If I had to lay a bet, I'd say it has nothing to do with the lake. It has to do with the mountains. Well, mountains, hills.
Hills.
Yeah.
High hills.
We'll say hills. Yeah.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Carol Ann in Cedar Grove. Hi. Thank you for calling.
I'm calling because Friday there was a storm out here, and it kept going around us, you know, out in the country out here where I live. But it was thundering. There was rolling thunder for 45 minutes. It rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled. We had a little rain, and we had a little hail, but it just rolled for 45 minutes. And I was wondering what would cause that to do that. No lightning that I could see. It just was the most beautiful sound.
Yeah. I envy you. I love to hear a story like that. I just wish I could have been there to hear it myself. I think what probably happened is you were on the periphery of some active weather, maybe to your north, maybe to your south, I can't say, that was maybe just barely touching you with rain and a little bit of the hail from the thunderstorms, but the concentration of all of that activity was somewhere else, but not far enough away that you couldn't hear the residual rolling thunder from what was probably even much louder and accompanied with vivid lightning somewhere within 10 or 15 miles, maybe 20 miles. So that's probably what it was. And why it would just kind of move past you in such a way has to do with the particular circumstances of that day. But it's not uncommon for that to happen in the summertime. It's rather uncommon for an individual to find him or herself constantly in such a peripheral position relative to such weather. So you don't get that happening all the time, and that's what makes it seem unusual. But someone, for every line of thunderstorms, is on the periphery of it and experiences what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Carol, for calling. John in Grand Rapids, Wisconsin. Hello.
I was just wondering if your guest could talk a little bit how the Great Lakes affect the weather in the Midwest and Wisconsin. I was born and raised in Superior. I was up there over Memorial Day weekend. It was like 90 degrees everywhere except for Duluth Superior, which is about 45 degrees and foggy.
Yeah.
And then about two weekends later, I was camping in Two Rivers, and they have what they call lake effect weather. It was about maybe 10 degrees cooler than normal, but not like 40 degrees cooler.
Yeah, no. Well, sit tight. Next weekend is summer in Duluth and Superior, right? The 4th of July is summer and everything else is winter, so you've got summer coming next week. The Lake Superior is the biggest body of fresh water in the world, and it's very, very deep. So there's water in that lake that never gets above about 34 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's a huge 80 or more percent of the volume of the water in that lake never gets above that temperature. The surface temperature, though, is the one that is going to affect your air temperature the most dramatically, unless it's very windy. Then you can, with strong winds coming over the lake, let's say from the northeast, you're going to churn up some of that colder water, which by virtue of it being colder is a little bit heavier, more dense, and so it doesn't sit near the surface. And so you can churn up lake surface temperatures that are pretty cool on a windy day. And if it's from the northeast, you're going to have a long fetch over which the air that's doing the churning is actually going to be cooled in the spring, especially the early spring and maybe late spring and early summer. It's going to be cooled by contact with that cold water. And so by the time it's delivered to your face, you know, in Superior or Duluth, it's 30 or 40 degrees colder there than it is, you know, down in, I don't know, someplace about an hour or so south. So the lakes have a huge effect on the weather in terms of temperature. And Milwaukee residents know this. There'll be certain days where we'll be in the mid-90s here in Madison, and at certain times of the day, it'll be maybe 80 degrees in Milwaukee, and that's the Lake Michigan lake breeze coming in. And somewhere between Milwaukee and Waukesha County, or maybe in Waukesha County, there'll be a thunderstorm that pops up along the front that's at the front edge of that cool air coming off the lake, and that might be the beginning of a thunderstorm complex for that night. So in the summertime, there are innumerable lake effect displays around the whole region. And in the wintertime, of course, that's also true. You can get enhanced snowfall from a larger scale storm, or you can just get local lake effect snow that is quite dramatic. Of course, we talk about the northern tier of our state on the Superior southern shore as the snow belt, and that's appropriate. Places like Hurley and Ironwood, Michigan, get hundreds of inches of snow a year, 110 or 120, and it's all from the lake.
Yeah. And it's funny, I was thinking as you were talking about being in Milwaukee on several occasions and watching the weather on television and or even hearing it on the radio, it always ends with "and cooler near the lake."
Yeah, it sure
cooler
does.
Near the lake.
Yeah, and much cooler sometimes. I brought my daughter to the Brewers game in County Stadium when she turned 5 or something many years ago. And it was sunny and warm when we left Madison, and it was 40 degrees during the whole game. We followed the sun around the whole park. No one was there.
Oh, man. Warren in La Crosse. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. My question is this. With today's increased technology, it doesn't seem to have improved the accuracy of weather forecasting. Why not?
Utterly,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Utterly incorrect. Utterly incorrect. It's absolutely an indefensible statement, and I'll tell you why. The 1 to 2 to 3 day forecast today is in a different league than it was even 20 years ago. If you keep score and really endeavor to keep score about accuracy of weather forecasts, you're certainly going to have days where the forecast is wrong. Those have not disappeared from the landscape. But more than 85% of the time, I'd say bordering on 90% of the time, you will have a very accurate forecast of the next day's weather, the day after that, and a very accurate characterization of the weather on days 3, 4, and 5. This is a revolution that we should be greatly pleased with, and it's a revolution that's a result of the funding of basic research in our country. Probably the most unheralded advance in science in the second half of the 20th century is numerical weather prediction. In addition, weather radars are all over the country. I go to coach Little League Baseball, or Larry goes for his golf outing once a week. Every clubhouse, every concession stand at baseball fields, they have radars.
Yeah.
And not only that, the people who are there buying a Gatorade or getting ready for their round, they know how to interpret it. And that is an observation. And so people can make a forecast in the next half hour or hour themselves now, which is absolutely a revolution. This wasn't true 25 years ago. So, I would definitely disagree with that statement. I think if one keeps score in a really aggressive manner, you'll find that I'm telling you the truth.
There you go, Warren.
You bet. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling. Bob in Prairie du Chien. Oops. Let me see if we can find Bob here. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank John for all that he does. apparently he's at UW Madison.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I don't want to be too cynical, but I once was at UW Madison, and 31 years of teaching meteorology and earth science in Wisconsin, that is ending. So how do you address the fact that as a state, even though you're on public radio, which should mean somebody cares, earth science education is considered meaningless as opposed to only biology, chemistry, and physics? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
I'm not sure what you mean by earth science is no longer considered important in the state. I'm a little bit confused about that because we have a fairly strong program in our own science, which is a small component of the earth sciences. We have a fantastic geology program, geography program. The Institute for Environmental Studies here is world class. I'm a little bit confused about that. I know that at the elementary and junior high and then high school level, the earth sciences are sort of a last ditch place for people to maybe as a junior or a senior in high school start to discover all these interesting things about environmental and earth and atmospheric sciences. That's unfortunate, I don't think that's new, and so I don't think there's been any crusade to make that true. I would be very happy to be involved in a crusade that alerts younger minds, 5th, 6th, and 7th graders perhaps, about how wondrous the atmosphere is. There might be geology colleagues who would want to teach them a little bit about the earth, and I think all those things are good. So I think I don't feel that myself. You know, we feel respected as a science. We feel like we're doing interesting things. People are engaging with us. This show has been on for a long time, almost two decades. It's testimony to that kind of interest. So I feel pretty good about the state of affairs. It can always be better, but I don't like to be cynical either, and so I won't complain that it's terrible.
All right. And on that note, we're kicking you out.
All right. I'll go find Steve.
Go find Steve. John, thank you so much. You'll be back the last Monday of
July.
July. Oh, man.
Unbelievable.
And we'll have a lot more to talk about. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. He will be back with Steve Ackerman. They'll do it all over again. Tomorrow we'll talk about white nose syndrome in bats with Dave Riddell and Jennifer Cher Riddell from the DNR. And also look at the smoking ban that's been in effect for a couple of years now statewide. Stay with us. Lots in store.